Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street. Online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one is going to be spent with a colleague of mine from Carthage College, Jean Preston, director of the Writing Center, talking about a beautiful children's book which she helped to create, inspired by a real story, real life story, at the Open Wings School here in Kenosha. In part two of today's program, you're going to be hearing from violinist Frank Almond, concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, who is playing a free concert this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha as part of their highly acclaimed Fine Arts at First series. So we have lots going on today, and we'll announce a few other exciting things that are going on this weekend as well. But first, right off the bat, I'm delighted to welcome to the program Jean Preston, as I said, director of Carthage's Writing Center, adjunct assistant professor of English as well, and responsible for a beautiful children's book called Banner and the Butterfly. And she is here. I have the book right in front of me. I read it quite some time ago, absolutely loved it, and loved the true story that inspired it. So we're going to talk about all of that over the next few minutes. Jean Preston, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you here. Great to have you here. Explain, first of all, your own connection with the Open Wings School here in Kenosha. And I know you're not on the staff there or anything, but I know you know something about it. So maybe you can help our listeners understand, for those who don't know, what Open Wings is all about.
Well, Open Wings is a school that is open to absolutely any child, but their focus is on helping children with special needs to really thrive and to learn. And so my granddaughter, who has a seizure disorder that she developed when she was about 2.5 and has struggled with that challenge ever since, began going there as soon as the school opened, and she spent 4 wonderful years there. Loves it.
So tell us about this particular project that came about. This book, which you have written, is something of a fundraiser for Open Wings, if I understand correctly.
It is. So Open Wings does a yearly fundraising event. And 2 years ago, at their fundraiser, I was talking to the principal, Kim Ackles, and I said to her, what if I were to write a children's book that you could auction? They have a silent auction and a live auction at your next fundraiser. And she was very enthusiastic and said yes immediately. And as soon as she walked away, I thought to myself, what did I do? I don't know how to write children's books. I'd never written a children's book. I'm a poet. And so then I struggled with probably the worst writer's block of my entire life.
Wow.
To the point that I was embarrassed to even go to Open Wings because I didn't want to be asked about it. And so finally, I just told myself what I tell my creative writing students, which is just sit down and get something on paper. And the major inspiration, I had asked him to tell me something about Banner. Banner is a service dog. Her daughter, Ainsley, goes to the school, Kim's daughter, and Ainsley has autism, and Banner is her service dog. And so I said, tell me something special about Banner that I don't know, because I need something. And she said, well, he absolutely loves to get into water. And she said, if he sees water, it's very difficult to keep him away from it. And so that was the beginning inspiration for the story. And it took off from there. But finally, when I got something on paper, it started out much differently than it ended up. But I was pretty happy with the result after much revision.
Well, as someone who helps other people write, you're well acquainted with the process of revision.
Yes.
Whether you're revising someone else or revising your own work. I mean, I really appreciate the fact that you're saying something about the difficulty of writing a children's book, because I know from all the children's authors I've interviewed over the years, chiefly through the cooperation of John Stuig, who used to head up the children's literature collection at the Hedberg Library at Carthage, speaking to them, it really becomes clear that it's its own art form, and it should not be entered into lightly.
It's very difficult. mean, it's,
it might seem at a glance like it's easy, but it really isn't easy at all.
No, it's not. And you're considering age group, vocabulary, the density of the text. And this text itself had multiple purposes because I did want it to be a fundraiser for the school. So I wanted it to showcase the school but also have a story that was interesting and intriguing for children that would keep their attention. So hopefully we've pulled that off
right,
with the help of the illustrator.
Absolutely. We'll talk about her her beautiful work in just a moment. So just kind of take us inside the process by which this book took shape, and in particular, the process by which you revised kind of your initial efforts to tell the story of Banner, this service dog.
Well, my initial idea was to have Banner break away from his owners and go to Lake Michigan and get lost. And then have the butterfly, which is sort of open wings, a symbol for them, have a butterfly lead him back to the school. But that was sort of an Odyssey type idea, and it was way too ambitious for a children's book, at least for me, and it didn't tell the story of the school enough.
It got him away from the school.
And so then I just decided that the first day of school would be a good place to start, because then it would introduce the school to people just like it introduced it to those children who were there for the first day. So that was the inspiration. And the whole water thing just tied together. And, of course, there's some poetic license in here. They don't have a swimming pool at Open Wings that they pull out on warm days, I don't think. And as Kim reminded me, they don't serve homemade bread and strawberry jam at lunch. But we do in the story.
Right. There you go. So what did you end up finding out about service dogs, and especially this kind of service dog that would serve a young child with some sort of autistic disorder?
Well, I think Banner is, for Ainsley, is like a calming influence. And so from what I understand, some children with autism, and autism has a wide spectrum of symptoms, but can get easily agitated, or things can make them frightened, or they just get very excited and can't settle in. And I think Banner provides that for Ainsley, and he is just a part of the school. We were just there, Mayuko, the illustrator, and myself went there just this week to do something for Mayuko's final senior project. And Banner was among the children. They were sitting on the floor listening to the story, and he was just lying, you know, on the floor next to Mayuko, as calm as could be. And he's that calming influence for all the children there.
So Banner is not specifically tied to her?
He is.
Oh,
he's her dog.
But the good he does, or the good he creates, or the calming influence he creates, in a sense, pervades the whole school.
Everybody loves him. Yeah. He's famous now. I was at a fundraiser for autism this weekend at the Union Hall on Washington Road, and Banner was there. And Kim told me that after I had left, someone from Carthage came to the event who knew about the book but had never met Banner, saw the dog, walked up and said, "I bet this is Banner."
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
So he's famous.
That's neat. I think one thing that was let me reintroduce you. For anyone just joining us, I'm speaking with Jean Preston, director of the Writing Center at Carthage College, and the author of a beautiful children's book called Banner and the Butterfly, inspired by the real-life story of Banner, who is a service dog for a little girl at the Open Wing School here in Kenosha. And so this beautiful book, Banner and the Butterfly, was created as a fundraiser for the school, a school which has its doors open to literally any young person, but especially exists for the sake of children with various kinds of special needs. I think, Jean, one of the things you handled very, very well in this book was the nature of the difficulties of this girl named Ainsley, because I should think that's maybe a tricky thing to write about, certainly to talk about, the fact that the reality for a young girl facing that kind of difficulty can really be harsh. And you probably could have spelled that out in a way that might have been really hard to read or so on, or maybe kind of taken our attention away from other things you wanted to say. To say nothing of maybe revealing more than, you know, should be revealed in a book about, you know, a little girl who hasn't asked for that kind of publicity. I don't know. There's probably all kinds of things you thought about. Just talk a moment about how you decided to finally talk about Ainsley and her own issues and, you know, what she needed in order to be successful.
Well, I think it wasn't so, it's not so much about the challenges that any of these children face as much as it's about, let's see, how safe the school is, and how nurturing the school is, and how they make these children just children. You know, they're children who are learning. And it's not about the fact that Ainsley has autism or Reagan, my granddaughter, has seizures and that she's on all these medications or whatever. That's not the focus of the school. So the focus of the school is learning. And just like any school, and helping each of these children reach their greatest potential, just like any school. So I think I didn't want the disabilities or the challenges that these children face to be the focus. It's there. It's the reason for the school.
Right.
But the major purpose of the school is to educate all children to the best of their ability.
Right. I think that's great. And I think you handled it nicely in that what it becomes about more than anything is just Ainsley being nervous about going to school, which is something that a lot of kids face.
Right.
That's nothing limited to somebody who, you know, might be on the autism spectrum or whatever issues they're facing. Just about every kid is very anxious about that kind of thing. And it's so heartwarming to read about the enormous difference that Banner made when it came to that.
Yes.
You were telling me before we went on the air that obviously, a children's book like this cries out to be vividly, vibrantly illustrated.
Right.
And that's something you yourself know almost nothing about. Tell our listeners about the process by which you were able to find the wonderful illustrator who has created kind of the vibrant visual element here.
Well, being attached to Carthage is a wonderful advantage because we have wonderful students and they're talented and just enthusiastic. And it dawned on me that I should take advantage of our art department and talk to the chair of the art department, Diane Levesque, and asked her for some recommendations and of students who might be interested in a project like this. And she was very excited because she likes to help her students understand what the real world will be like for them when they get out there and have to, you know, push their own projects and make presentations. And so she recommended two wonderful young women to me, and they both treated it as a professional opportunity. They both read the story. They both did thumbnail sketches. They came to talk to me and gave me their ideas, and then I had to choose, and it was a very, very difficult decision. But ultimately, Mayuko Kawashima's drawings just had the lightness and the spirit that I thought the book warranted.
Talk about then the way the book visually and physically took shape. I mean, and how much of this was a collaboration between the two of you once you said, this is the artist for me.
Diane tells me, and I was totally new to this, that the collaboration that I had with Mayuko is somewhat unusual in that there's usually a middle person, an art person who's sort of a project director or something.
Right.
I don't remember the exact title she is, but there's usually someone in the middle who talks to the author and says, we need to change this, or talks to the artist and says, we need to do that, whereas Mayuko and I work together. And I had the text was pretty much complete, and I gave it to her, and she did all the drawings, and then we sort of decided where to break the text up and where to put the illustrations. And then with working with publisher, we had to decide how many of those we could afford to be color and how many we needed to be black and white, and to make the book stay affordable. And it was really an interesting process. And then there were these things called, I don't know the artistic term, but the scanning of the illustrations had to be in certain pixels or whatever in different ways for black and white and color. And thank heavens Miyuko understood all of that because we're like, blah. And so she really had the bulk of the work in January. This was her J-term project. And we submitted everything, I think it was like the 26th or 27th of January, and crossed our fingers that we would have the books in hand for the February 27th fundraiser, which we did. So it all did work out.
Very good. So you have had a number of these printed up, and they can be purchased then by anybody who's interested in reading the story and seeing these illustrations and almost more importantly, interested in supporting Open Wings.
Well, so we had an initial order, and actually that was I ordered a small amount and a number of books, and that was my donation to the school this year, and then we sold those, and they are gone. We had a fundraiser at the fundraiser itself, and then we had a book signing at Carthage, and Banner came, and he paw-printed the books.
Oh.
So that was great fun. So he was at Carthage, and he was paw-printing books, and so we sold out of all the hard copy books and almost all the soft cover books, but there are more on order, and they can be ordered actually through Open Wings. If you go to their website, or you can email me at Carthage College, mpreston@carthage.edu, and we would be more than happy to give you a book. And all proceeds do go to Open Wings.
Wonderful. By the way, what kind of dog is Banner?
He is a black lab, and he is just a big, old, gentle, wonderful dog. Hmm. And he's blue in the book, sort of a dusky blue color. And that's something I learned about illustration is that it's very difficult to render a black dog because there's the light and the grades of color. It's very difficult to work with. And so we decided if Clifford can be red, Banner can be blue.
Absolutely. Well, Banner is absolutely beautiful. And the whole book is absolutely wonderful. So
my favorite picture is where he's happy in the whole book and excited and wagging his tail, but when he thinks he's in trouble, that is my favorite picture of him.
Mm.
He's all of a sudden afraid and nervous like Ainsley.
All right. Well, and any dog of that particular sort of breed that wants so much to do what's right.
Right.
We can understand where they're coming from. It's a beautiful book. Again, Banner and the Butterfly. You can contact Open Wings if you would like to purchase a copy for yourself. And the writing is by Jean Preston. The beautiful illustrations by Miyuko Kawashima. Jean Preston, I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. This
thank
was really,
you.
Really fun.
Thank you for having me.
Speaking of Banner, a service dog, good friends of ours have a service dog at Walden School in Racine, and Reg is a very beloved figure in that school, and he is also part of the cast of the Racine Theater Guild's current production of Bridge to Terabithia. And, of course, many of you know that wonderful book, and it has been adapted for the stage. There are still performances this weekend where you can see Bridge to Terabithia at the Racine Theater Guild, and you can call them at 633-4218 for more information. Lakeside Players is doing Disney's Aladdin Jr., and those performances are this weekend at the Rhodey Opera House in downtown Racine. I know among other things going on, the musical Xanadu is being done at Bradford High School. Godspell is being done at Horlick High School in Racine. And close to my own heart, at Racine, at Carthage College in Siebert Chapel, tomorrow night, the culminating event in the No Hate Week at Carthage is a performance of the one-act chamber opera, which I helped to compose earlier this year, called Black September, based on the real-life hostage crisis at the 1972 Munich Olympics. Although it is a heartbreaking tragedy that propels the story, it's ultimately, thanks to librettist Matt Barresi, a really uplifting story of courage and love in the face of something unspeakably terrible. So that that performance is tomorrow night at 7:30. It will also include a brief performance by the Carthage Choir. Again, this is an event that culminates No Hate Week at Carthage College. And Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, Frank Allman, the concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, will be performing a concert at First United Methodist Church. That's at the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street in Kenosha, part of the Fine Arts at First series. In anticipation of that, I want to replay a portion of a past conversation with Frank Almond, and I certainly want you to hear a little bit of Frank Almond's magnificent playing as well. This is in the music of Schumann. Frank Almond playing the beautiful Lipinski Stradivarius violin, and that is what he'll be playing this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church. Here's a portion of the conversation he and I recorded just before he played a spectacularly successful recital at Carthage College. I promise we're not going to talk about this a lot, but I just have to begin with the fact that, of course, for a time, you were probably the single most famous, talked-about violinist in the country for the most unpleasant of reasons, of course. And I'm, of course, referring to the attack and the theft and all of that terrible unpleasantness. And of course, glad to say that the violin is back safely in your hands and you made a complete recovery and all is well with the world again. I just wonder if you could say a quick word about what it felt like to be amidst the swirl of interest about you and this precious violin and this unspeakable act of violence against you and this instrument. I mean, I should think in your wildest imaginations, you never imagined such a thing would be possible. What did it feel like? I mean, were you in any way prepared to sort of handle a situation like that?
Yeah, I'm just kind of mulling all of that over again. Yeah, it was surreal and bizarre, and I don't think there's any way anyone can really be prepared for something like that. I certainly had never experienced any kind of criminality or act of violence like that, nor had I ever predicted it, or even, you know, in my wildest dreams would have never thought of anything like that happening, especially involving a violin. You know, it's one thing to get your wallet stolen, but it's something else entirely when there's a Stradivarius involved. On the upside, there were lots of silver linings to it once things got a little bit less chaotic, and it's very odd, you know, in a certain way the story is still going on and it's still very much in people's consciousness. I bump into people all the time who want to talk about it and who remember it probably as vividly as I do. Maybe not, but it's just an unprecedented crime, and it was an unprecedented event in my life, certainly defining in very various different ways, and I'm just really grateful that it wound up the way that it did in a lot of different ways. I mean, like I said, there were a number of silver linings. I think it brought a lot of attention to the arts in this area, to what that instrument actually is and the role it plays in not just my life, but the community's life around here. And, you know, hopefully elevated people's awareness and consciousness in a certain way. But it certainly was very strange to be at the center of that storm twice, actually. You know, there was the initial incident itself, and everything just sort of turned upside down for 4 or 5 days right after the theft. And then just as that was kind of dying down, they found it. And then it all started up again for other reasons, you know, happier reasons. But nevertheless, it was just everywhere and impossible to get away from, even if I wanted to. But I was happier after they found it, obviously. So I just did the best I could, and I don't think you can be prepared for something like that on any level.
Right. So you began playing this violin in 2008.
Right.
I'm sure it's not possible for you to share probably all that we would be interested to know about whatever transaction, in a sense, placed this precious violin in your hands. But I wonder if you would care to just tell us whatever you can, whatever you feel comfortable telling us about how those transactions, at least in general, sort of work. And does somebody come a calling, or do you go a calling? I mean, in search of an especially beautiful instrument to play. I mean, I guess I'm most curious about sort of how you and this violin ultimately came together,
right.
And if a somewhat complex agreement needs to be brokered, or if in this case, or generally speaking, is it actually a relatively simple transaction, albeit with something incredibly valuable, even priceless, at the heart of it?
Well, there's no formula for the way these things work. I've had the good fortune to play on any number of fantastic instruments in my life, really since the age of like 14 or 15. And one of the really interesting things about this particular instrument is, well, up until the theft, it was really almost an unprecedented reappearance of an instrument of that caliber. And it happened to just sort of fall out of the sky and land in Milwaukee. I can give you the short version, but there actually is a fairly well-documented account of how this violin resurfaced and how I came to play on it again. Basically, what happened was I got an email one day that I wasn't quite sure what to make of. You know, a couple times a year I'll get an email or some kind of contact, like, I've got a Strat in my attic or something like that. And this one was a little more interesting and had some facts in it that really intrigued me. And it certainly wasn't any kind of offer of a loan or anything. It was just inquiries about a particular instrument that had been in a certain family. And I was intrigued because I wanted to see it. And it turned out that the violin had really not been seen publicly for about 20 years at that time. This is in 2008. And I didn't really know much about it. And it kind of snowballed from there. It turned out there was a very strong connection to the city of Milwaukee. And over the next few weeks after I received that email, the owners and I had gotten together and become pretty close. And basically, I was just sort of advising them on what you do when you have an instrument like that. Like, they were, I think, looking at options in an estate situation, and this is what happens when you sell it, and this is what happens when you keep it, and that sort of thing. And happily for all of us, they decided to keep it, and they wanted it involved in the community, and they asked if I would sort of look after it and play it. And I think it took about 3 seconds for me to agree to that.
Well, you just answered my next question then, but I'll have you maybe just elaborate a bit. Was there any reason to be at all hesitant about, in fact, taking this instrument and, in a sense, taking care of it and playing it and so on? I mean, did you feel any trepidation for any reason whatsoever, or was any trepidation swept away by just the notion of being able to play such a wonderful instrument?
No, I didn't hesitate at all. I mean, mostly because it was I was very familiar with instruments on that level. First of all, like I said, I'd been really lucky to have a couple of them on long-term loans before that. But more germane to this situation, I became very close with the owners before any of this ever got talked about. And there was an element of trust and an element of altruism, I think, to this particular situation where they wanted the violin played for all the right reasons. And that's, I think, was really key to why it worked out as well as it did. And it was all, I you know, actually, now that I think about it, I mean, that's one of the reasons I think that it was such a huge story when the violin was stolen as well. Hmm. Because the owner, I don't know if you know it, but the owner made one or two public statements about the instrument and the situation during that whole saga. And that really resonated with people. I mean, these were not grandstanding philanthropists who were loaning out an instrument for their own attention. Mm. They saw this as really something that was connected with the community and connected with the musician who was here and wanted it played.
Right. And so, I think that's also probably a big part of why when this occurred, in a strange way or to a surprising extent, it felt like something that happened to all of us. I mean, it affronted all of us who care about music and care about the Milwaukee Symphony and who care about you. And, I mean, it was just a – if any crime could resonate well beyond the single person and the single object stolen, it was a crime like this. I mean, it was a crime against all of the community in a sense.
Yeah. That's a very good way of putting it. I mean, there was a lot of attention to that instrument when it did come out and resurface again in 2008. There were a couple of big articles about it, and people can find those online if they're interested. But, you know, people were aware that this instrument was in the community, and I was playing it for many years, as was the perpetrator of the crime.
Hmm.
So, you know, it has its pluses and minuses.
Right. In the wake of the violin's recovery, first of all, my recollection is that the violin was essentially okay, undamaged in this experience. Is that right? I mean, did it come back to you exactly as you remember it being before it was stolen?
Well, it didn't come back to me exactly in the condition that it was stolen. I don't think it could go through something like that without some sort of bumps and bruises. But amazingly, there was no serious damage to the instrument. Mm. And that's a miracle, in my opinion, mm. given what I know about how it was treated and how it was stored and all of that for the 8 or 9 days mm. in between. So, there certainly wasn't anything major, and within a few days, it was sort of back to normal.
Hmm. And speaking to back to normal, I wonder what it has felt like since to be out and about with this violin. To any significant extent, are you sort of conducting such business as walking around with it differently than you did before?
Well, I think that if something like that happens, one can only imagine that you know, various precautions and protocols are followed that were different than before. I mean, everybody I know who plays on an instrument on that level, I think this incident really got their attention.
Hmm.
Not necessarily because somebody would try something again, for the same reasons anyway, but I think it really just jolted a lot of people. And from my own standpoint, there were just practical things we had to do. I wish I could go into it more than that.
Sure, of course. No, it's the last thing you should do, of course.
There are lots of precautions that are taken now that I would have never imagined before, you know.
Well, and I should think that among the many silver linings that you mentioned is that probably violinists all around the country are caring for their instruments in probably far more attentive fashion than before this unfortunate thing happened to you.
It's possible. I hope so, but it also has to be said that to this day, and to my knowledge, with all of my newfound police and FBI friends, this is the only case on record of an armed robbery of a high-end old Italian instrument. Hmm. It's the only one that's ever occurred.
Wow.
So that should tell people something. I mean, when they're stolen, they're usually stolen in a very different way, if they're ever stolen. I mean, it's extremely rare for one to be stolen, and they almost always turn up.
Hmm.
There are only two. I mean, I knew actually a lot about this even before this had happened, just because I was very careful and did a lot of research about it. But I think there are only two of these instruments that have still not been recovered since, I think, about 1994. There are only two out of any number that had been stolen.
Hmm.
But it's still a very, very rare occurrence because you can't do anything with them.
Right.
If you steal it, it's worthless.
Right.
As these guys found out.
You're hearing a portion of a conversation recorded with Frank Almond, concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. He is playing a free recital this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha, the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street, part of their Fine Arts at First series. You say that you've had the pleasure of playing all kinds of marvelous instruments throughout your career. Is it too crass to ask if this is the finest of all those instruments or your favorite? I mean, maybe that's just that'd be like asking a father which of your children is your favorite.
You know, it's funny. That's the first analogy that came to mind. But I will say that there's a reason that I think almost any violinist wants to play on a Golden Period Strat. And that particular year is very special in a number of different ways, but certainly that period in Stradivari's life was quite extraordinary. He was at the apex of his powers as a craftsman and as an engineer and as an artist. And so there's something really special about this instrument to play it, even leaving out the history behind these things. Although I will say I've played on some other quite extraordinary instruments that had very special meaning to me as well.
Hmm. So. How much of this instrument that you hold in your hands is the same instrument as was first made in 1715? I'm assuming that certain aspects of it, I mean, certain small parts of it at least, are perhaps different from that that dates back to 1715. Do you have much notion of that?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question, and I think that a lot of people are unaware of certain aspects of instruments from that time that were commonly changed in the hundreds of years in between. There's almost no Stradivari on the planet that hasn't been altered in one way or another. In the most significantly, the neck actually they've almost all been replaced. There's one or two that I know that are different. And it's because when people like Paganini and, for that matter, Lipinski came around at the time of Franz Liszt and sort of the age of the virtuoso in the 19th century, suddenly you were playing in bigger halls and not just rooms full of 200 or 300 people. So the neck was lengthened on the instrument, which necessitated replacing it, of course, and also the advent of steel strings or composite strings, different kind of bridge, different hardware on the instrument itself to accommodate that kind of change makes it really a different instrument in certain ways than it was when it was crafted in 1715. So for this concert, I'm playing the Bach chaconne, I believe, and it literally is a different instrument from what would have been considered a Baroque violin at that time, although a very powerful Baroque violin and very different than something like an Amati, a Niccolo Amati, or something like that from the same period. It's they're different instruments, but they've sort of been adapted for modern use in a way that didn't really affect the actual nuts and bolts of the instrument itself. Hmm. The scroll where the pegs are, that's the same. The body of the instrument, everything else is the same. Hmm. But, you know, the tailpiece and the bridge and the strings are all sort of changed often these days, just in terms of maintenance.
Right. Is this, generally speaking at least, the violin you always play? I mean, when you are at home practicing or whatever the concert is with the Milwaukee Symphony or whatever the performance might be in some sort of solo venue, do you, generally speaking, always play this violin, or do you have several? And are there certain situations where it makes sense to turn to another instrument?
Yeah, well, that gets back to the sort of security measures that we were talking about. I wish I could say I'm always playing on this instrument now, but I can't. I can't say it, and I can't, because it's just a lot of things have changed.
Sure, sure.
So that's, you know, the best answer I can give you.
Right. I guess the heart of my question was really, is this instrument especially good for certain, or especially appropriate for certain repertoire? And for other kinds of repertoire, would you, all things being equal, tend to turn to another violin, or is the Lipinski Stradivarius such an instrument that it makes magic even in music written 200 years after it was built?
Well, you know, I've always said since I got this thing to play on in 6 years ago, I felt like I was going through its life, not the other way around. So the more time that I could spend with it, and the more I got to play on it, whatever the music and whatever it is, I'm going to do that, because to me, that's incredibly good fortune and a gift. So I don't really care what I'm playing on it. I'm going to play it. Now, of course, if you're playing outside at a Pops concert with a Zeppelin cover band, I might use something else just out of necessity, but I would have done that anyway, you know, with any instrument.
Sure.
But as far as types of music, it's not really relevant.
Right. Otherwise, I also am curious, I think our listeners would be curious to know, too. I mean, I happen to be a pianist, and I'm always acutely sensitive to when you sit down and play this piano versus that piano, the matter of touch and feel can be profoundly different from instrument to instrument. How different is it when you are playing this Lipinski Stradivarius versus another really, really fine violin, maybe even another Stradivarius, but not this particular instrument? How different is sort of the feel, the touch, if that's the term that gets used when we're talking about a violin, when you go from instrument to instrument?
Well, the strange thing about these instruments is that, especially with high-end instruments, old Italian instruments like Guarneri's or Stradivarius, and some of the Amati family, in my experience, they really are different, and depending on, they sort of shift around depending on how much time you have with them and on who's playing it. So it's difficult to describe, but it does take a fair amount of time for you to adapt to an instrument and vice versa, as strange as that sounds. Stradivarius especially are not known for really being user-friendly until you really learn how to use them to the best of both of your ability. And what I mean by that is that it's a little bit, I sometimes use the analogy of a high-end race car, you know?
Hmm.
If you're used to driving around in a a certain kind of car, and then somebody gives you a Lamborghini. they're very easy to rack, you know?
Right.
And if you're used to playing, for instance, on an instrument that maybe is not as high quality as something like this one, you work a lot harder to get certain effects and certain colors and certain sounds out of it. And then Stradivarius really don't respond well to that. You almost have to learn how to work less. So it becomes, when you get good at that and learn what the instrument can do and what you can do with the instrument, it really just becomes a very, very high-end tool of the trade.
Hmm. It sounds a little to me, I happen to play a little tennis. I don't know if tennis is a sport you ever play, but it sounds like it might have a little... be a similar situation to when one plays with a different racket, and certain rackets are built much better than others, but often there'll be that one model that really becomes your best friend, with whom you are almost at one and feel such a high comfort level.
Same principle. I mean, it would have to be probably a very, very expensive racket with an incredible history behind it. The point is the same. It's not true that if you give any musician a Stradivarius that they're going to instantly sound great. And I think that's something that is really difficult for a lot of people to understand.
Hmm.
I'm perfectly capable of sounding awful on this instrument if I just don't, you know, if it's not really working.
So if Jack Benny had taken the Lipinski Stradivarius in hand, it's not like his violin playing would have been suddenly transformed.
No, probably not, although he was actually, I think, a lot better violinist than he let on.
Of course he was. Of course he was. Frank Almond, of course, is a superlative violinist of the highest rank, concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, and he comes to Kenosha, to First United Methodist Church, this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock to play a free recital as part of the Fine Arts at First series. This is a rare opportunity to enjoy a first-rank artist at the height of his powers. Violinist Frank Almond. Monday on the morning show, you're going to be hearing my conversation with the author of a brand new book about Kathleen Kennedy, or Kick Kennedy, as she was nicknamed,